Welcome to On the Line with the AMA, the official podcast of the American Motorcyclist Association. I'm Alexandra Terhorst. Our guests today are AMA Motorcycle Hall of Famers Peter Starr and Scott Hardin. Peter is a celebrated filmmaker and motorcycling ombudsman who's widely known as the producer and director of the iconic movie Take It to the Limit, which marked its 40th anniversary in 2020. Scott is a multi-time desert racing champion and three-time ISDE medalist, who later became an industry leader. In today's conversation, Peter and Scott reminisce about what inspired them to race motorcycles and later pursue successful motorcycling careers.
You know, Scott, one of the things about being in the older generation is to look back as far as I can to the time when motorcycling first impressed me. And I have to say, growing up in England after World War II, owning a motorcycle was something that you could only dream of. I remember quite clearly when I was about 15, my high school art teacher came to school on a Friday afternoon during racing season, riding a 16H Norton with a flatbed sidecar. And strapped to the sidecar was a 350 BSA Gold Star race bike. And as a kid of 14, 15, and all of us actually sort of got around this bike and sort of cheered him on in many respects, because he would take off after school finished on a Friday off to whatever local racetrack he was racing at. And that started me drawing motorcycles during my art class. And I remember clearly looking at photographs of John Surtees in the MV Agusta and that kind of rider and that kind of motorcycle. But it wasn't until a couple of years later when one of my friends, Barry Eccles, showed up with a BSA Bantam with clip-on handlebars at school. And he was the first person I knew to have a motorcycle. And I got to ride that at some point, much to my parents' chagrin, I might add at the time. But there was my interest in motorcycling. And it's done nothing but get deeper and bigger and wider ever since.
You know, just hearing your story reminds me what a great age to be young and be alive right after World War II and seeing all the changes and development, and especially after what Great Britain went through, and then seeing all these things come about, things like motorcycles pop into your life, the freedom that they must have meant to you. It's really cool to hear. You know, today, so little is left to the imagination. Everything is 24/7 media. Back then, I think, you know, the imagination is what drove all of us, is that we saw snapshots of things, but we had a lot of blanks that we had to fill back then in our minds about what was really going on. And I think that had a lot to do with what fueled us to take up the sport, was imagining the possibilities and what all it could mean for our lives.
Well, when I first started at Mallory Park, which is my local road race track, and reading the newspapers and so on, and seeing what little we could on television back in those days, which was like a 9-inch square black and white tube, we'd get reports of the Isle of Man TT. Names like Gary Hocking and John Surtees and Bob McIntyre, Alistair King, Jeff Duke, of course. I mean, these were guys that became my heroes. My heroes were not soccer players, which most kids were. They were motorcycle heroes. And that's has never really left. I'm not a stick and ball person even today. My heroes today are guys like Greg Hancock, who, you know, four-time World Speedway champion, and people of that ilk. I mean, even Garrett Gerloff, who's the new Yamaha guy in Europe in MotoGP this coming weekend, and is the World Superbike guy. Guys like that, I much prefer to look up to and look out for than any stick and ball player that you could name.
You know, I came along a few years later in the late 60s, and my first experience with a motorcycle was at deer camp, deer hunting. One year, one of our friends bought a tote goat up there, which was little more than a glorified lawnmower engine strapped in a steel box channel iron frame and no suspension, but it had an engine and a throttle, and that's all that mattered to me. And I convinced them to let me ride it, and I ended up riding it the whole time we were at deer camp, so much so that when we came home, I just bugged my grandparents to no end to take me down and buy me a mini bike. And back then, you know, they were selling them in lawnmower shops and all sorts of weird places at Sears and Montgomery Wards, and you could go down and get a mini bike. And I remember we went down to a local lawnmower shop and pick up a Taco 22. And that was it, as far as I was concerned. Once we unloaded that thing, we lived out in the country in Las Vegas, lots of desert surrounding us and farmland and stuff. And once I had that thing, I had wheels to go anywhere I wanted. And I would take off and be gone all day. And so from 11 years old, I had mechanized dream machines to ride and go on great adventures with, and something I'm still doing today. And really not much different. The only thing that's different is the distances I can go and the speeds. But other than that, it's about the same.
My experience has changed a lot. I mean, I started out racing in 1961 as a road racer, very young. But in England, in those days, people start riding here at such a very, very early age. But in England, if you were riding a motorcycle at 16 or 17, that was very early. Because following World War II, nobody had the financial resource. And even when I bought my first bike, I was already working at Triumph, and my parents wouldn't allow me to have a bike unless I was going to buy it myself. They didn't want to contribute to that part of my life. They were fearful, to be quite honest, that I would kill myself. But when I started working at Triumph, it was all up to me at that point. The funny thing about having heroes in those days, I think it was 1959, I first saw Mike Harewood, a very young Mike Harewood, at Mallory Park. And from that point on, he became a hero. His father owned the largest motorcycle store in the United Kingdom called Kings of Oxford. And I actually went from Coventry to Oxford, about 40 some odd miles, which in England in those days with no freeways was a long way, to buy my first motorcycle from the store that sponsored Mike Harewood. I've always been a supporter of people that support racing, because that's what got me into actually buy my first bike. And I bought an Aerial Arrow, if you remember what that was, a two-stroke twin. And a 250cc two-stroke twin.
Oh my gosh.
And that was my very first bike that I owned, and eventually became the first bike I raced. My first racetrack was Silverstone, which is something you might remember from the GPs of today. It came very early. It was obvious to me that I needed to get off the road and get onto a racetrack. And it's a good job I did, because I'm not sure I'd have survived on the road. A lot of testosterone flying around for an 18-year-old at that time.
As it should be. It's funny, I had got that mini bike and I progressed up through other mini bikes, Powell Challengers and Honda CT70s, and eventually got the full-size dirt bike, a 125 Suzuki Duster, which I immediately stripped down and put a number plate on, and ended up sneaking off to my first race against my grandparents. I was raised by my grandparents against their orders. A friend of mine took me out and I snuck out to the races. Of course, they found out about it. And once they saw how committed I was to it, they decided to relent and they took me to the next race. But that was 1970. 71 was my first race. And I didn't even know who Peter Starr was at that time.
Peter's early career included a variety of film and recording projects. The path to making Take It to the Limit was paved by his love for riding and racing. That film would have a profound effect on a young Scott Hardin.
You had a big impact on me, Peter. Back then, On Any Sunday came out. Of course, that changed my life. Just the whole, you know, vibe from it, and watching Malcolm and everything that Malcolm did in the movie. When I was 14 years old, I resolved to do that myself someday. Win the Baja 1000, do 6 days, and ride the Elsinore Grand Prix and all this stuff. And that fueled me for a long time. But just about the time the residual benefits of all that imagery and everything wore off, another movie came out, and that was Take It to the Limit. And it came out just about the right time. It was a couple of years after On Any Sunday, and it had a similar vibe and feel to it, although it really focused in more on some other riders and some other disciplines. And between those two movies, all the inspiration that I ever needed to pursue a career in racing and motorcycling was fueled by that. You know, that's when I first knew that there was such a thing as a Peter Starr. And I always marvel at this, because I look back and now Malcolm's a close friend, and I've ridden all over the world with Malcolm, and we've hung out together now, Peter. And looking back, when I was a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kid, I always wondered, now I know what possessed you to do a movie about motorcycling. It was your love and your passion. But obviously, you know, you didn't go from wrenching on bikes and working at the Triumph factory to making Take It to the Limit overnight. You must have had some other training and some other education and some other things go on in your life, Peter. I was always curious what happened during that period, to Take It to the Limit.
Well, my first film was a film called The Bad Rock. And the way that came about was I was producing records at A&M Records in Hollywood, and we had a song called Dirt Riding Man that A&M Records wanted me to produce, and they wanted some sponsorship for it. And they said, well, you know motorcycles, why don't you do it? And so I set about trying to find a sponsor for this Dirt Riding Man, and we recorded a couple of versions of the song, but nobody seemed to be terribly interested. And the only person that showed some interest in anything was a guy called Marvin Foster at Hodaka. And he was the director of marketing at Hodaka Motorcycles, which was based up in Oregon. And I went up to see him, and we spent 2 or 3 days hanging out and riding and just having a great old time. And at the end of which he said, I don't want to buy your song. He said, but we need to make a movie about this event called the Bad Rock. Out of that, I looked at what they were looking for. And I said, well, I can do that. And not having made a film before, but having been around people that have made films before, I said, you know, let's do it. They said, well, what's it going to cost? And I said, well, and I had no idea, to be quite honest. It was, I was full of, you know, vinegar and other things that you can think about. And I said, $12,000. And he said, well, okay, we'll put up half of that. You go find another sponsor for the other half and we'll make it. So I came back to LA and I sat on the phone for a while trying to find a co-sponsor. And I found a guy called Fred Smith at Pennzoil. And Fred said, God, come on down and see us. So I went down to see him. And Fred said, that's not enough money. And I said, well, what is enough money? He said, I don't know, but let's start with $14,000 and we'll go from there. And he said, I'll put up half of that. So I went back to Hodaka, they put up the rest of it. And then I took off for Seattle to hire the people that I needed to hire that I'd worked with before on other television productions. And we put a crew together and we literally camped out in a little village in Oregon and connived our way through making this very first movie. It was quite an experience, not, you know, to actually do it. And from that point on, I made myself learn everything I could learn about every aspect of filmmaking to the point where I figured out, well, I knew what I was doing. And by that time it was 1976 and we'd already produced the Champion Sparkler Classic and the Roger DeCosta film and the Mowdy Smith film and a film called The All-American Race with Gary Scott and Rex Beauchamp and Corky Keener. And about that time, I got the idea of making Take It to the Limit. It took us about 4 years to actually film it. And it came out in March of 1980. That's a long time ago now, 40 years ago.
Oh my gosh. I remember when it came out, that was quite, it was quite the deal. It was something really to look forward to. It was another real motorcycle movie.
Well, the one thing I remember at the time was the music. I just come fresh out of producing albums with A&M and United Artists with groups like Spencer Davis and Tim Weisberg and the Canadian Rock Theatre and people like that. And music was so important in terms of movies. And I felt absolutely certain that it was going to be a big part of Take It to the Limit. And it turned out to be with groups like Foreigner, Jean-Luc Ponty, Tangerine Dream, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band that I worked with in putting the music together for that film. Because it's still to this day, I believe, a very important part of any imagery is the music. It can actually drive a film of that kind. And I still think that was what,
absolutely,
what the success was in that era.
Absolutely. I remember that. It's iconic. And all those bands, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, all that stuff. That's all classic.
Don't forget Arlo Guthrie singing I Don't Want
to. Yeah, that's right. Arlo Guthrie.
Yeah.
Induction in the AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame is a great honor for men like Scott and Peter, but it also motivates them to encourage riders to inspire the next generation of motorcyclists.
We've known each other a long time now through the Hall of Fame, and obviously you've kept involved writing books about motorcycling and everything. And what was your experience like being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
It was 2017, and I'll be quite honest with you, there was nobody more surprised that I can think of, because it was an honor that I really didn't expect to ever get. I hadn't done enough, if you like, in the sport to warrant being considered as a racer. And I wasn't quite sure that even with all the films that I've made, that it warranted being in the Hall of Fame. But I happened to be in Florida doing a lecture tour. And I get this call from Ken Ford, who said, you're being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I'm going, yeah, okay, you know, which joker is this, you know? And I didn't believe it was him. And he finally said, no, it's for real, it's for real. And as we say in England, I was gobsmacked. There was no words.
Yeah.
And over the period of time, of course, from that moment to the induction, it was like I was on a different planet, because all of a sudden it felt like all the work I'd done had finally paid off in some way that was something from my peers, rather than sort of being financial and people paying to go into a cinema. It was like my peers recognizing something. And there was very few words that I could say to tell you how I felt about it. I look at guys like yourself and look at the racing you've done. And look at all the competition you've done. Look at what you've contributed to off-road riding generally. I look at people like you as much more deserving of that. So I'm so honored by it. You have absolutely no idea, because I look at you, Malcolm Smith, and all of the guys that have been competing way beyond anything that I raced as being the people that I think are prominent in the Hall of Fame. I just think I'm there, you know.
I can tell you for sure, you're one of the reasons I'm in the Hall of Fame. We all need people at critical times in our life, especially when we're young, to show us a vision of greatness and what things can transcend our lives and our life experience and everyday life. Motorcycle has so much going for it on so many levels, but you know, when you actually see it up on the big screen and you actually get to see it and you see what means the lives of other champions. And again, going back to your film, some of the racers you followed, Hannah and DeCosta and Roberts and all those guys, that just inspired me to want to do whatever I could to be a champion in my chosen fields. And I don't think I'm the only one. I'm sure there's other Hall of Famers that were equally inspired by that. So that's why you're in the Hall of Fame, Peter, is somebody has to go out there and show people what's possible and document what's going on and capture it for the next generation. I was just blessed to come along when all of that happening. Right now, I wish our sport had another Peter Starr, a younger Peter Starr out there that was creating the next great motorcycle movie that's going to inspire. And I know there's other stuff going on out there, don't get me wrong, but the days of On Any Sunday and Take It to the Limit and things like that, I don't think we can have enough of that motorcycling right now to inspire people to take up the sport and give it a try.
Scott, I think you're absolutely right. We're in a different generation now, as I see it, where quite honestly, anybody with a cell phone calls himself a filmmaker. I think the one big thing that's different between guys like Bruce Brown and if I may say so myself, is the creation of a story. It's the story and the people more than anything. And film was the medium. And we've lost a lot of that. I mean, we only have to look at the volumes. There have been volumes and volumes on television, most of which, if I can be immodest about it all, is a waste of time. We've lost the quality. I really believe that the films in the 70s and 80s were much more poignant than what we see thrown on television today. And I think to the detriment of our sport, really. I mean, television has done amazing things for MotoGP. I love MotoGP. I think it's the best sport in television there is. I think we could do the same thing with Speedway if we could only figure out a way to convince those people to do some onboard cameras and so on. That's another great sport that's not so much a motorcycling sport, but an entertainment sport on two wheels. I think there's a big opening today for that sort of stuff. But if you're not telling a story, it's very, very hard to get people's attention, particularly for people that aren't already attached to the sport. It's one thing, I think, to slap people on the back in terms of, you know, what a good guy you are, what a great motorcyclist you are. But I think it's another challenge, as On Any Sunday did, to get people from outside the sport to make a decision to become part of the sport. And that, I think, is one of the challenges of the future for the whole industry of motorcycling.
Now you're speaking that, you know, something that I'm very passionate about. As you know, 4 years ago, I launched the Plus One Rider Initiative, and it was kind of sparked by seeing the need to bring new riders into the sport. And while Plus One, there's nothing revolutionary or groundbreaking about it, I think it's important to remind everyone that the best people to advocate for our sport, to promote our sport, to physically go out and bring that next generation of riders into our sport are the current motorcyclists, guys like you and me. And while, you know, I'm not going to certainly go out and make a movie about it to inspire people, I do know in my everyday life and in my everyday travels in business and in pleasure and with my family and friends and the people that I come in contact with, that I have the opportunity to make a difference. So the risk of self-promotion here, and not really self-promotion, but just reminding everybody that we can all have an impact on it while we wait for that next great movie to come out. I think all of us should be more proactive about reaching out to non-riders, bringing them in, letting them see, giving them a little bit of a taste about what it means in our lives and how it inspires us and how it enriches our lives and how it really makes life so much better, and how the motorcycle is such a big part of it, and break down some of those barriers for fear and everything. And I think if each of us just took it on in a one-on-one basis, I think we could all have a big impact. And that's one of the things that I like to advocate for. And it's kind of taking what you and Bruce Brown did down to a very small micro level, but I still believe it works. And heck, with 8 million active motorcyclists or something like that right now, all we need is a small conversion rate to really affect the growth of the sport. So that's one idea, but I still think it'd be great to see something done on a large scale again. Something like you said, a movie with the real story behind it that could really inspire people. I still hold out hopes that a younger generation filmmaker, somebody that's willing to take on the challenge, will do that.
The issue is one of funding this kind of a project. The industry itself, over the years, has shied away from funding these kind of things. And they've left it up to Hollywood. And unfortunately, Hollywood has taken the easy road. And there hasn't been any real good stories that involve motorcycling or motorcycling. You know, some things have been good. I mean, we had James Brolin on that Doctor show where he rode a Triumph. I mean, that was it, brought motorcycling into a good light, and where a doctor would actually ride, and those sort of things were good. Well, Bert Munro film was terrific. I happen to know Roger Donaldson quite well, who was the director of that film. And I spoke with him at length about that. And he said the only reason that happened was because of his personal relationship with Anthony Hopkins. He said they could not get the money to do that film until Anthony Hopkins signed on for it. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Is,
wow, I didn't know that. That's a really cool backstory on that. And you're right. I when I saw Anthony Hopkins in that movie, I was surprised as could be, major actor like that to play a motorcycle guy. Yeah, that's pretty
interesting.
And
that was because Roger Donaldson had a relationship with him from other movies. And it just sparked Anthony Hopkins. And then he is what they call a bankable actor. I'll tell you another story that something that you probably don't know about, because it's not really been announced yet. But there's a guy in Australia called Eric Banner who is writing and working on a film about Mike Harewood's return to the Isle of Man when Harewood went back to win the Isle of Man in 78. Well, part of the story that he didn't know was in 77, I brought Harewood out of retirement and took him to the Isle of Man to make what was the climax of Take It to the Limit. And I met Eric Banner on a Skype call once he wanted to do this. And he's a bankable actor in terms of being able to raise the money. He also wants to direct it as well as act in it. He looks a bit like my Harewood. And that's the kind of—
Great actor, by the way.
Well, I don't know him very well, to be quite honest. We spent a couple of hours on Skype talking about how we brought Harewood out of retirement and how that whole thing happened, which is now part of what he's writing in his script, as I understand it. But it's things like that, which are real stories with real actors, that I think can help this sport a lot.
Peter and Scott are passionate about the role motorcycling has played in their lives. Their concern about regulatory challenges only fuels their eagerness to enlist more riders to join the AMA.
So here we are, it's 2020, crazy year, a year unlike any other, and about to head into 2021. I've been involved in motorcycling for a little over 50 years now, and you a little bit longer than me. Obviously, a lot of things have changed, and it's real easy for a couple of old codgers like us to look back and say, hey, those were the good old days. And we just had a killer year in terms of motorcycle sales, especially off-road motorcycle sales, which is good to see. Certainly, there's more challenges. What do you see are the challenges and opportunities moving forward?
Well, I tell you one thing that you just sort of touched on that sparked with me is I happened to be talking to somebody in the industry today who was kind of pointing out the fact that he's now old, he's almost 65. And I said, how dare you? You know, how dare you consider that to be old and thinking we have to keep moving forward? But my new book is called Motorcycle Travel, coffee table book. I went to 12 countries and rode around 12 countries, all of which I did after the age of 70. My whole thing is to keep people riding. I mean, bring in new people, absolutely, but keep people going, giving them reasons to do things. It's very easy for a person as they get old to sort of put everything to one side and get old. And my belief, and it's a very strong belief, is you've got to keep doing what turns you on, if you like. I mean, and if motorcycling is it, keep doing it no matter what. If it's not, maybe try it. You know, maybe get a small dirt bike and go out and have a crack at it, because it's old people that let themselves get old. That's one of the killer things. My belief is that old people just have to keep on trucking, I think is the term from the 60s, you know.
Well, I hear you. I figured the day I stop riding is the day I die. Definitely, I'm not ready for that. I see a lot of opportunity, a lot of change in motorcycling. There's a lot of new motorcycles coming out. The manufacturers seem to be responding to try to build product for newer, younger riders with smaller displacement, more manageable, less intimidating, which I really applaud. I worked at KTM for 20 years and Husqvarna for 15 years. And the last company that I was officially associated with was Zero Motorcycles for 6 years as their VP of global marketing. And I still see electric motorcycles as a big part of that future of motorcycle. The experience of riding an electric motorcycle is unlike any other. It's very zen-like. It's very peaceful. It's great performance. No vibration, no heat, no sound. I used to describe it as a magic carpet ride on two wheels. And I still think that electric bikes, and especially as they develop more and more range and shorten their charge times, I see that as being attractive to a whole new generation of younger riders. So I'm hoping the technology will come together to bring new riders to the sport as well. And I hope the industry continues to respond and make product that are more appealing to people to get them out and riding. Some of the new stuff's pretty impressive, you have to admit.
Some of the new bikes I think are exciting, but there's one issue that I think the industry will be needing to face in the not too distant future. And that is the way that our government is very quick to clamp down on our various rights that we have. And this includes rights for some off-road trails and off-road areas, but also on the road. Motorcycling is the low-hanging fruit when it comes to politicians that like to wield their power. And one of the things that I'm hoping that we might deal with in terms of the AMA and the people that are involved is we need to be better armed, I think, for the future, financially and with the, quote, army of people behind them, so that the people that represent us as lobbyists in Washington and other areas actually have a real good army behind them of people they can rely on. We should have a million members of the AMA to make sure that governments that want to outreach their power don't take it out on us. It's a major issue on my mind for the future, because I love the sport and I love to ride, and I detest power-hungry politicians wanting to take a swing at somebody that basically doesn't yet have the power to swing back.
You won't get any argument from me. I'm a big fan of the AMA and proponent of it, and I'd love to see us get up to 500,000 members and then shoot for a million. They speak for us collectively. Our voice is just the only thing that we have that really speaks for us collectively. We have a lot of threats facing us. Once autonomous cars start hitting the highways, how do motorcycles factor into that world? Is it too much of a pain in the butt to even consider it? Are they legislated out of existence? Who knows? Already you see where they're starting to legislate internal combustion out of existence. So while I'm a big fan of electric, and I think it has its place, and certainly it needs to be sold on its merits in terms of how well it performs as a motorcycle, legislating it into existence is absolutely against everything that I believe in. I believe in the free market. Let the free market determine what wins and what doesn't. Getting more members, I think that's part of the message as we bring in new riders, is supporting that message about the strength in numbers and how we need to come together as a group. We're so independent and we're motorcyclists and we like to get out and do things on our own that it kind of runs against what we believe in. But when I was fighting land use issues and I was on different boards of directors for ORBA and other agencies fighting against it, I saw the money that Sierra Club was raising annually to fight environmental issues. And I looked at what we had to work with. It was just appalling, the differences. And we need to get behind the organizations that represent us. And on the user side, it's the AMA. It takes work, takes time. We just need to come together as a sport and as an industry. And there's a lot of good things ahead for us. And, you know I look forward to riding for a long time to come. I mean, I have four different bikes in the garage right now that I ride regularly. And I do a lot of adventure motorcycle riding and a lot of off-road riding still. So hopefully we'll keep the sport alive and going for years to come. And obviously we've got a big influx of riders this year that just bought new bikes that plan to use them for the next few years. So we've got that going for us. But is there anything you wish you hadn't done or is still on your bucket list? Maybe it's on your bucket list of things to do. I mean, you've traveled all over the world. You've done all this stuff. And I know you never stop thinking about this. What's next? What do you look forward to most?
That's a really interesting question. And it's a very difficult one for me to answer right now, because the one thing that you probably don't know about, but I had a catastrophic kidney failure back in December. And it's taken a very, very long time to recover from that. And I've only recently recovered to the point where I can actually ride a motorcycle again. It's been a very, very strange year, because not only had I just recovered from it, then COVID happened. But I've still got ideas of riding in different parts of the world. I've got ideas that I'd like to think about even making different kinds of movies. I'm 78 years old now, but it hasn't stopped, and I don't expect it to stop. It's just going to change based on what the environment is in terms of raising money and actually getting things done.
I had heard about your health issue. I knew you had a tough year, and I knew you had some things to overcome. But I also know that the best thing to get you healed up is to look forward to something, your next challenge. And I hope you're thinking about that, because we need you out there telling stories and creating content.
There's a whole philosophy of called living a life of purpose and living a life with purpose. And I know, because of my studies in medicine, that people that have a life of purpose, particularly people with cancer, survive longer and have a happier life. This whole concept of ensuring that you have a purpose to your life is so, so important. I'm hoping this winter to develop in my mind, what's going to be a plan for the next 5 years or so. And that's the middle of what I'm doing right now, to be quite honest.
Well, good. Don't stop, Peter. Don't stop. Keep dreaming and keep planning and everything. Just don't stop. That's all I can say.
Our thanks to Scott Harden and Peter Starr, two Hall of Famers who continue to inspire motorcyclists with their words and actions. On the Line with the AMA is a production of the American Motorcyclist Association. Since 1924, the AMA has been promoting the motorcycle lifestyle and protecting the future of motorcycling. To learn more, visit AmericanMotorcyclist.com.